It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, investigative reports found hazardous conditions at 3 barrel recycling plants in the Milwaukee area earlier this year. We'll find out where inspections of the plants stand today.
Now, the country seems deeply divided over after violence broke out between white supremacists and counter-protesters in Charlottesville. The president commented on it more than once, but his remarks yesterday have been some of his most controversial.
And after the violence, the debate over Confederate statues has been revived again.
Share your thoughts on the president's comments in about Charlottesville at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know what you think of his response to what happened over the weekend and the response to his response from Democrats and Republicans.
Scott Wong joins us to recap that and more for today's Look at the Week in Washington. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he focuses on Paul Ryan and House Republicans. Scott, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the president appeared to return to his initial position on Charlottesville yesterday, where he said that there are people on the what he called the alt-left who share the blame. Here he is.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
Scott, tell us a little bit about how the president's remarks have been digested. What's the reaction been?
I think there's been a lot of shock on the part of Republicans. You know, this story has evolved over the course of 3 or 4 days. The president weighed in initially on Saturday after the violence broke out in Charlottesville and maintained that both sides there were elements of both sides to blame for the violence. And then a day later, he sort of walked it back and read a prepared remark that said, you know, it was very clear there was no place in his party, in the country, for white supremacists, for neo-Nazis, etc. That seemed to have quieted the storm in his party for a bit. And then, of course, yesterday he was right back at it with a very lengthy, combative press conference in Trump Tower back in New York, where he reverted back to his original position, maybe even going a step further, saying both sides, the white supremacists or the white nationalists, as well as the counter-protesters, were to blame for the violence that broke out in Charlottesville that left one woman dead, and of course, sadly, two state troopers lost their lives monitoring that situation.
And Scott, what is the thinking behind the president's remarks yesterday? As you said, it seemed as though the storm had kind of quieted down, and then he made these remarks yesterday. They seemed, some people have said they were unscripted and the White House didn't know they were coming. Is that true? Do we know if these were planned remarks or what the nature of them was?
Well, he originally had planned to talk about infrastructure. He had members of his economic team, cabinet members, Elaine Chao and a number of others with him on that day at Trump Tower. It was not supposed to be, I believe, a long press conference. He was going to say a few remarks and then go back upstairs. But obviously, he could not help himself when reporters started asking questions. He's somebody who likes to engage with the press. He's somebody who likes to, go back and forth with reporters, call out fake news, as he did yesterday. Even when it appeared that the press conference was wrapping up, he got some questions on the side and continued to answer questions from other reporters who had not had a chance and continued to have side conversations and couldn't quite leave the press conference. And so that's just a characteristic, I think, of this president. He's a combative guy, and he likes to mix it up.
And tell us about the reaction within his own party. Among Democrats, he's been widely condemned for these remarks. What about within fellow Republicans?
He's been widely condemned by GOP leaders, by members of his own party, certainly critics in his own party who see this latest episode as a reinforcement of, you know, their previous beliefs of what the president stood for. Many of his former presidential rivals, people like Marco Rubio, who has been very outspoken, Senator Lindsey Graham. I will note, though, that of all of the top leadership, including Speaker Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, and even on the other side with Senator Mitch McConnell, nobody in their tweets or statements directly called out the president by name, as we've seen from maybe some of his other critics in the party. And I think that's because they don't want the president to sort of return fire or turn on them like he's done to so many people in the past who have crossed him.
We're talking to Scott Wong right now, senior staff writer at The Hill, where he focuses on Paul Ryan and House Republicans. And Scott, at that same press conference, the president also talked about protesting Robert E. Lee statue removal in Charlottesville. And here's his take.
Many of those people were there to protest the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee. So this week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week, and is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
And what do the president's remarks do for this debate, which has been going on for a while with different results about the removal of Confederate statues?
Well, I think the important thing is what he said was he's going to let the local jurisdictions deal with this. He certainly did weigh in and say, you know, this is a slippery slope. Does this end up with statues of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson being removed? Of course, Thomas Jefferson played a big part in the founding of Charlottesville and founded the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And of course, is a president who's had a difficult and challenging history with slavery himself. I think, you know, the president's comments, even more so, I think the actions of what took place in Charlottesville have really accelerated the removal of these statues. We've seen this happen. Protesters tore down a Confederate statue in North Carolina this week in the wake of Charlottesville. Just overnight, we saw three statues ordered to come down, three Confederate statues ordered to come down in Baltimore. And so, you know, other cities, other jurisdictions and states are looking to Charlottesville and saying, we don't want this same sort of violent clash to happen in our community. We're going to try to be proactive and get out in front of this.
Now, some African-American members of Congress have said it's time for the statues to go. Do you have a sense that there could be any legislation coming, or right now is this something that's just being talked about?
I think we're seeing a lot of statements. Obviously, Democrats in particular are pretty fired up over what's happened the past few days. Members of the Congressional Black Caucus have called for Confederate statues to be removed from the U.S. Capitol. There are, I think, 9 total statues of Confederate figures, everyone from, including, I would say, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy and his vice president. But we're not hearing anything about legislation that would change the rules or the laws. Basically, the way it works is each state under current law gets to send 2 statues to the U.S. Capitol. And so if those states wanted to replace those Confederate statues, they certainly could do so. And I think that would happen at the state legislature and governor level. But so far, we haven't seen, and of course, members of Congress are on recess. They're back in their districts. And so the most of what we've seen are statements so far, and we're not expecting a whole lot of action on this issue until maybe they get back in September.
And Scott, it was a really bad weekend for the country. 3 dead in Charlottesville. We had the president's remarks. They created a big reaction yesterday and over the weekend. Mm-hmm. Is this the end, or are there more shoes waiting to drop?
You know, I think the biggest shoe that's dropped in the wake of Charlottesville has been these CEOs who have served on President Trump's economic councils on his manufacturing council. This started with the CEO earlier this week of Merck, who resigned, saying that the president's remarks in response to Charlottesville were inadequate, and it's just continued to spiral with a number of other CEOs dropping out from Trump's advisory councils. These are, you know, mainly these councils don't do too much, but it's more symbolic when you have CEOs from major corporations like GE and Under Armour and Merck basically distancing themselves from the president. It's not a good place to be for the White House. And so I think more than any statements that we've seen from members of Congress, the real action that has occurred in the wake of Charlottesville has come from corporate America.
We're talking to Scott Wong right now, a senior staff writer at The Hill, for our weekly recap of national politics.
And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the resignation of a bunch of CEOs from these presidential advisory councils, which were then dissolved after those defections? What do you think of the response to what happened this weekend in Charlottesville from the president, from his critics, and from his supporters? And what news are you watching for out of the nation's capital? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
More to come here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're looking at this week in Washington with Scott Wong. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in with your reactions to this weekend's events, to the president's reactions and statements. And there have been questions about Republicans possibly who might run a primary campaign against President Trump. Is that something you'd like to see happen? If so, who should run? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, go ahead and take a caller now. We've got Tom first in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. An interesting discussion. My points would be in relating to the statues and the controversies that arise from statues of Confederate leaders and such. I do not view it in the terms of being racist or I look at it completely from the CSA, the Confederate States of America, being a traitorous. They're traitors. These people seceded from the Union. They had separate trade deals. They had elected leadership. They did all sorts of things. And, you know, despite the fact that some of their generals were outstanding, West Point educated, extremely smart tacticians, these people fought for an enemy that declared war on the United States of America.
Tom, thank you for that call. And Scott, there are different strands of thinking about these statues. Some people saying as monuments of history, leave them up, but put in context. We had a guest yesterday from Columbia University who said maybe there's nothing wrong with the statues themselves, but where are the statues, where are the monuments to slaves and other figures representing the full spectrum of history? And then we've heard from other people like Tom who say that the Confederate statues memorialize traitors to our country. What is the thinking right now on this?
I think it's an interesting debate. I think some of the concerns about why communities want to remove statues have to do with African-American people who walk by these statues every day, that they are a constant reminder of them, of slavery, of what happened in this country. I don't think anyone is saying we need to, completely deny what happened in the country. I think the argument is that, let's put these statues in, the argument that we're hearing from most folks in Washington is let's put these statues in a museum. Let's not deny what took place in this country, but to put it in a public square like that, where people are reminded of that, the tragedy of slavery and the original sin of slavery, it may be a little bit too much for people to bear.
Thanks a lot, Tom. And we'll go next to Katie, joining us from Lake Mills. Katie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for this great discussion. My concern is just that we need to educate people about the rise of Nazism in the 1920s and 30s that led up to World War II. My dad fought in World War II. He was in the bloodiest battle, and he was gravely injured, and he went there to fight the rise of Hitler and make a stand in the world that the world is not going to stand for this. We stand on the side of humanity. And I don't think people really remember that the conditions were exactly the same as we're facing today with the employment situation and targeting groups of people and blaming them for the way the economy is. I think this is what this is all about, and we have to educate people. And I'm really glad to see that the public exerted enough pressure on these CEOs who came out today especially and resigned their position, because in the wake of the Citizens United decision, ordinary people really don't have as much influence as our founders intended.
Katie, thank you for that call. And Katie talking about her father fighting in World War II, fighting against the rise of the Nazis and Hitler. And that's something that was echoed in a response of Bernie Sanders, right? Scott?
I'm not familiar with Bernie Sanders.
I believe in a tweet he said it was embarrassing. I'm paraphrasing, but embarrassing, you know, the memory of those who died to fight the Nazis.
Oh, certainly. I mean, there are, thousands and thousands of Americans went over to Germany and other parts of the world to fight the Nazis, and many of them lost their lives. And I think there was a very memorable tweet from Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, who said, my brother lost his life during World War II fighting for Nazis. You know, why are we having this? Why are we having this political debate so many years and decades later? Obviously, that was a painful part of history for all people, because that was World War II, and no matter where you were in the world at that time, you were impacted by it. And so it is a strange time in our political history that we are revisiting many of these issues that a lot of people thought were well in the past.
And Scott, as our time gets a little shorter here, I want to ask you about a couple of other stories. Politico published a story on Monday that said President Obama had been warned about Russian attempts to meddle in Western democracies. What do we know about that story and what the Obama administration did or did not do?
Well, based on that reporting, it seems that intelligence agencies had been warning the president and his administration about Russia's disinformation campaign and efforts to disrupt the U.S. political system in the final years of Obama's presidency. That would be, between 2014 and 2016. And so it raises questions about, whether whether President Obama and his people did all they could to try to stop some of these cybersecurity threats that we know today, did have an impact on the 2016 election. Russia clearly tried to influence the election, and President Trump just this week seized on that report and tweeted saying that Obama ignored the warnings because he didn't want to anger Russia. So President Trump looking for any sort of angle here to blame the president and take maybe some of the pressure, some of the political heat off himself as he faces his own Russia investigation.
And finally, Scott, another story. You've been thinking about 2020 and currently Trump's approval rating, 34% right now, the lowest that it's been yet. And the New York Times has reported that there is a so-called shadow campaign forming for 2020. And I don't think anyone has declared for this. No one has said, yes, I'm willing to run in a primary against the president. But, what are the odds that that could be the case?
I think the odds are pretty low that somebody could successfully primary President Trump. He has, he has a strong base among conservatives and within the Republican Party. However, I think you are seeing some jockeying and some positioning even in 2017. Here we are 3 years out by a number of people. You know, Ben Sasse, in the Senate, Nebraska Senator, Jeff Flake, and Arizona Senator, both are very big critics of the president. And use every opportunity to sort of pounce on his missteps. Obviously, a former presidential rival and centrist Republican, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, would love for another shot to take on Trump. And, you know, I mean, we may even see somebody, a celebrity, given the rise of President Trump in the last election, how he was able to knock off so many very well-accomplished politicians, we may see a celebrity, somebody like Mark Cuban, the businessman and entrepreneur.
Yeah, and you say Dwayne The Rock Johnson, maybe?
Well, I think we're having some fun there. But you know, I mean, we're talking about Kid Rock possibly running for the Senate. And so in the age of Trump, I would say anything is possible, and there's no idea too silly given what's transpired in the country over the last year and a half.
So, you know, Mike Pence, that was floated, was it a week ago? Maybe Mike Pence was running one of these shadow campaigns, but he has said kind of absolutely not. Would that be considered kind of high treason among the Trump campaign if Pence were to be thinking about that?
Yeah, I think Pence is being very cautious about how he's being perceived by the president and the president's closest allies. He wants to appear in lockstep with the president. But at the same time, he would be the preferred favorite candidate if Trump were to, for some reason, step aside or have to resign his office. Obviously, everyone would look to Mike Pence, the vice president, to step up in his place. And so Mike Pence, it's interesting, as you mentioned, is returning home from a trip to South America. He's returning home early amid this latest controversy over Charlottesville. I think he wants to appear that he's not detached from the situation, but trying to stay on top of it and also to be supporting his president.
Scott, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Scott Wong's a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he focuses on House Republicans, and he joined us for a weekly look at the top stories in national politics.
Right now, an investigation by the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel earlier this year uncovered dangerous conditions at three barrel recycling plants in the Milwaukee area. Mixtures of hazardous chemicals routinely put the health of workers and nearby residents at risk.
Since that reporting, several agencies have inspected the facilities, including the Environmental Protection Agency and the Wisconsin DNR.
However, OSHA has been slower to respond, prompting criticism from some elected officials.
John Diedrich is a reporter and an assistant editor on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's investigative team, and he's been covering conditions at the plants. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's reporting has covered six barrel refurbishing plants, including three that are near Milwaukee. Can you walk us through what it is these plants do?
Well, these are barrel refurbishing operations. Essentially, they take 55-gallon drums and larger plastic chemical totes. We're familiar with these. They're used in industry for a lot of varied items that they carry. They might be food items or chemicals or whatnot. These operations take these drums and totes and clean them out and refurbish them so they can be used again out in industry. And what these operations do is that they may repaint them, and if they're too damaged or whatnot, they might just be recycled for scrap. And when they do go back, the question is, how do they get these items refurbished and be able to be used for the industry?
And your investigation at the Journal Sentinel revealed that there were some dangerous practices going on that seeming to result in harm. Sometimes it sounds like fumes and explosions. Can you tell us about the risks and what you found?
Yeah, my colleagues and I, we found that this industry, which is not very well known, has had a series of incidents that have happened and ongoing danger. The way we found out about this was there was a whistleblower who was a was hired by the company, his employer was, and he went into these facilities and saw a lot of dangerous practices, chemicals that were being mixed together, drums coming in, barrels and totes that were still contained more material, chemicals and whatnot. They're supposed to come in empty, but they were coming in partially full. That in the burning operations, the recycling, there were fires and flashbacks, that there was danger not only to the workers immediately in the area from fumes and fire and explosions and things of that nature, but also to the surrounding communities. So here in Milwaukee County, we have three facilities, one in Elk Creek, one in St. Francis, and one in the city of Milwaukee. And then we have three others as part of this chain in other states as well. And we documented a series of incidents. And as the whistleblower went around, he heard from the company's own safety people that they were concerned about the safety itself. And that's why the whistleblower came to us. And from there, we assembled a lot of the reports and other documentation that showed that the risk was there not only for the workers, but people who lived near these operations.
And this was a big story. And looking at what's happened since that story broke, how many of these plants have been inspected or have seen any sort of follow-up action by OSHA?
So all three of the operations here in Milwaukee County have been targeted for inspection by federal and state regulators. This is EPA, Department of Natural Resources, so that's the Environmental Protection Agency, which is federal, the State Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Transportation, and as you mentioned, OSHA. What's interesting, at the beginning of this inspection operation or effort, the EPA went in to do an inspection, and one of the things they were concerned about was that they were not seeing the true nature of the conditions in the plant as federal law requires. And so they actually went to a federal judge, a U.S. magistrate judge, who signed a warrant allowing them to do a true surprise inspection. Separately from that, the EPA sent some of their regulators into the neighborhoods around these plants to talk to residents. And their findings were interesting on one level, in that they talked to a lot of residents about health problems that they were having and smells and things of that nature. But then the EPA investigators themselves got sick. The two inspectors who spent nearly a week near the St. Francis facility. So that raised concern about this. The DNR spent quite a bit of time in all three operations here in Milwaukee County and found violations in all three. And then recently, OSHA, which had not been into any of the facilities, did go in, and now they've opened an inspection into the St. Francis facility. But they are not; they have not opened inspections into the other two facilities. Now, you asked about all six. There is a chain of six, and we have no indication at this point from the authorities that inspections have happened in the other states, but have happened here in Milwaukee County.
Now, this is a story that caught the eye of Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin, who at some point was concerned that only one of the facilities had been inspected. Now there's two on the board. Does this answer her concerns about OSHA's inspections?
Well, she raised this question a number of times, and to be clear, OSHA did inspect the Cornell facility, that we call it the Cornell facility, but because it's on Cornell Street, but it's in Milwaukee, about 24th and Hampton. That facility had been inspected in late 2016 and early 2017. And at that point, a fine was assessed of about $100,000, and they found that some chemicals were mixed together. But since the new revelations came out from the whistleblower, OSHA had not been back to the Milwaukee facility, nor had they gone into Oak Creek and St. Francis. And Senator Baldwin's point was, why is OSHA not going in? If EPA and DNR see risk to residents nearby, certainly the workers who are in there are at risk. And what OSHA's response was to the senator and to us was that, you know, we don't have a complaint from a worker, and without a complaint, we can't go in. Well, Senator Baldwin pointed to OSHA's own rules, which say that they could go in for a referral, including from media reports. So she pointed to Journal Sentinel coverage and said there's certainly plenty here to warrant going in. And the day of the report that we wrote about why OSHA is not going in fact, that very day, they ended up opening up the inspection in St. Francis. But for reasons that are not clear, they have not opened an inspection into the Oak Creek facility, nor into the three in the other states that we reported on.
Is it possible that there could be some legal follow-up to all of this?
Well, there is in terms of, so the DNR right now has issued 19 notices of violation against the company. This is a subsidiary of a large packaging company out of Ohio named Greif, and these plants are they're in partnership with other corporate entities owning these. That company is meeting with the Department of Natural Resources here in August for some enforcement conferences. Depending on how those resolve, they could be legal action taken on those violations. In addition, EPA is looking at violations as well because they went into the facilities in OSHA. So these are all civil violations. There also has been some discussion of possible legal action by residents. That's not very far progressed, but that's they've been queried by attorneys, and certainly they have questions about their health and welfare, and you know, concerns about longstanding health issues, and possibly if those could be related to those. So that's, you know, sort of the area of question right now is, you know, where's the accountability on this, and, you know, what steps might be taken to ensure that these operations are safely executed.
John, thanks a lot for catching us up.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
That was John Diedrich, investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He gave us an update on hazardous working conditions at three barrel refurbishing plants in the Milwaukee area.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Coming up, schools around the state are gearing up for the new school year, but state lawmakers still haven't passed a budget, and that means schools don't know how much funding to expect.
We'll hear more about that in a bit, but now we're going to talk a little more about the feelingsy side of back-to-school season, and we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent sending your child off to school? Maybe for the very first time, maybe kindergarten? Maybe to college. How do you feel about that?
As a parent getting ready for the new school year, are you sad to see the summer end, days at the pool, or just kind of long days with lots of grumpy people kicking around the house? Are you happy to get back to a little more structure, a little routine? Do you look at the school calendar and all the activities, and do you feel overwhelmed, excited, or maybe a little just tired?
And if you're a student yourself at any level, we'd also definitely like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What does the start of a new school year mean to you? Does it feel full of opportunities and a fresh start, or are you a little nervous about how it's going to go? Call in with your thoughts, your feelings, your nostalgia maybe about back to school season right now. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page.
We've got a lot of great student workers here at Wisconsin Public Broadcasting, so we asked one of them what she was feeling.
I'm Rachel Romanek. I work for WPR and WPT in their production department and with the Quilt Expo. I'm starting my last semester of college here at UW-Madison, and I think what I'm looking forward to most is actually the office supplies. I'm one of the few people, I think, who does love going out, getting a fresh set of pens, some notebooks, more than I need, definitely.
So, yeah, the office supplies are fun, I guess. But I remember as a kid, though, being into getting that exciting new Trapper Keeper, folder.
Trapper
that was...
Keepers. But here's a question for you. Did you ever actually use the Trapper Keeper?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you mean as intended?
As intended. I never did. I bought it and then, yeah.
No, I think I kept folders in with the Velcro and the folders
you
were
lie.
Contained inside. I'm pretty
Nobody
sure.
used them. Did they?
I don't know. But maybe you can let us know your Trapper Keeper memories at 800-642-1234 or your general back to school thoughts. Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Callie is on the line in Wausau. Callie, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What are you doing this back to school season?
Well, I'm very much looking forward to back to school. I have a twin 6-year-old, mm-hmm. and we had summer school this year, so we loved summer school. And now, but since they've been gone, not going to school for the last couple weeks, by the time I get home from work, they're with their grandma all day, and they're just at each other's throats. They're bored. They're ready to be back at school. So am I, and I'm very much looking forward to that. And I love that smell of the school supplies when we go shopping at the grocery store. So
the smell
very
of the
exciting
school
time for me.
Wonderful, Callie. I'm sending twins off to high school in a little bit. So they do keep getting older. Thank you so much, and good luck with back to school.
Let's go next to Carl joining us in Eau Claire. Carl, hi.
Hi there.
What is your memory?
Well, for me, being here at Memorial in Eau Claire for high school has just really been, like, the best thing. And when I go, as the summer comes to an end, as I'm getting ready to go back to school, I get really excited. I'm excited to see my friends, excited to see my teachers and get my classes going for the next year so I can hopefully prepare myself better for going to college and into my career.
Wow, look at you, Carl. You're setting a good example for everybody. You're all excited. Are your friends in the same boat, or are you the guy who's like, shut up about school already, Carl?
Well, we're kind of all in the same boat here. We're all excited. We're all very competitive when it comes to school and stuff. So it's really good motivation to keep us going throughout the year. And it's just really, I'm really excited to go back.
Well, good for you, Carl. That's great to hear. See, here is a young person brimming with motivation and excitement about school starting. That's great, Carl.
That's how I was every year in school. Yeah. Okay, maybe not. Thank you, though, for sharing your story, Carl. We appreciate it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is going through your mind on back-to-school season, whether you're a parent, a student, former student, teacher, you name it? We'll go next to Chris on the line in Evansville. Chris, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm a retired teacher, so every year at this time, about 2 weeks before school starts, I get that feeling that I should go there and I should get my room ready and put all the posters up and make all the plans and put my clothes out the night before, pack my lunch. It just, this time of year, it just all comes back to me, and it's kind of sad to know I'm not going back, but not totally sad.
Yeah, is there a little bit, I mean, I understand it's a bittersweet probably, but is there a little bit of a feeling like, hey, wait, I don't have to go ahead and get that classroom ready after it's been sitting vacant all summer?
Oh, yeah, that definitely is there, too. But I think any retired teacher just has a little twinge this time of year.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, Chris. Thanks a lot. You can call in with your back-to-school season memories or current feelings at 800-642-1234. We asked around our coworkers, our colleagues. Judith Kovalik in our marketing department said, I'm sad my daughter's summer break's almost over. It's fun to see her happy and carefree, playing, sleeping in, enjoying that unstructured time. Sending her to school feels like sending her to a full-time job, but we'll settle in and enjoy the time learning and seeing friends and doing the structured activities. It's just getting over the transition, she says.
She also says, mostly I dread packing her lunch every day. Lunch packing is worse. And this is something I think that a lot of parents relate to, but no one says out loud, which I feel, because I have a hard time every day with the packing of lunch. This year, I have a new Tupperware organizer, so I'm hoping that it's not going to be me at midnight looking for lids, which is usually my life during the year. So the lunch packing is rough, but there is something about those crisp fall days. I have an inner Carl, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're
when it comes to school.
It.
And my kids definitely relate to Carl as well.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, again, with twins, it's just kind of an assembly line approach to packing lunch. Like, you just do it all at once and divvy it up. So that works pretty well. Do you have debate in your household? Like, one kid wants this, one kid wants that?
Yeah, everyone's got their customized meal plan, but really, I think the kids should be making their own lunches. They're probably
old
enough.
We've done that some.
Yeah, did it take?
Yeah, we probably should have started way earlier, as with so many things.
Yep, I hear that. But it is a curious thing, getting that feeling in the beginning of the year. Fall comes, and you start thinking maybe you should be at school, getting ready for school yourself. I have that twinge that Chris was talking about for college. To me, the memory of going back when I was in college, those are my, you know, that would be okay to go back to school again.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Abe is on the line in Green Bay. Abe, hi.
Hi. I'm a university student and a school teacher myself, and this time of year is a time of year where, you know, I prepare for work again and try to get back in the routine. But it's also a time when I remember so many of our kids that and families that don't have the supplies and resources that they need for school. So it's a time I remember that. And sometimes, for example, this year, I try to get involved in organizations that do such work.
Abe, thanks a lot for the call. There are a lot of, I think, businesses and nonprofits that do help out with that. Actually, we heard when we asked around here, a Simply Folk host, Dan Robinson, said he was talking with a grandmother who buys her grandkids back-to-school supplies. She spent for three kids upwards of $1,000. So he was having the same worry for people who can't afford those school supplies. So, Abe, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your thoughts.
Abe, thanks for that. And we go to Kayla next in Milwaukee. Kayla, hi.
Hey. I'm actually driving home for my first day of school.
Oh, evening. Boy. How'd it go?
We've already started.
Did it go well?
Yeah. This is my eighth year teaching, so it's just kind of getting back onto the horse, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mixed feelings. I am going to miss sleeping in, but it's good to be back in routine and to see my new students.
Right. So a little of the rough stuff, giving up sleeping in, and the good stuff, the excitement of new beginnings. Yes, sleeping in is a big one. Kayla, thanks a lot for that, and I hope you catch up on your sleep this weekend.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Cindy on the line in Fox Cities. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I'm anxious to go back because I'm a school bus driver, and the school bus driving is my second income, so I'm looking forward to having a little extra in my pocket every week now.
I got to say, Cindy, as a kid who rode the bus to school, K through 12, basically, even then I was aware, man, this must be a tough job because we're terrible. We're terrible sometimes. How is it dealing with the kids?
It's not so bad. I've been doing this for 25 years, so I guess it's like being a teacher. You get the knack on how to kind of control the kids. So,
all right. Thanks. Well, good luck. Have a great year driving bus, Cindy.
And classical music host Stephanie Elkin said, even though I don't have children in school, the day after Labor Day has always been one of those points on the calendar that represents new beginnings and a chance to hit the reset button. Stephanie says, I feel it even more strongly than around New Year's.
And we heard from Dean Kallenbach at our Eau Claire Regional Bureau. He says, my kids are out of the nest, but it still makes me kind of excited to see all those school supplies in stores. The memories, Dean says, that really come back are those of high school football practice, which happened in those hot August days before school gets started again. As a farm kid, Dean says, I really looked forward to those opportunities to reunite with my friends. So
yeah.
I'm guessing there's a lot of people out there, like the athletes who have those sports that start right around now, excited about getting back out on the field.
Right, and my kids are looking forward to seeing their friends again, and that the sports are another aspect of this. I guess there's fall TV, but that kind of conflicts with homework. I don't know. Are your kids, are they sleeping in? Are you going to have a hard time with the transition?
They do. They sleep until like 7:30 now in the summer, so that's not too bad. Yeah, we'll have no problem, I think. Well, thank you so much for all of your calls and comments. And you can keep it going, by the way. Answer the question, how do you feel about back-to-school season, whether you're a parent, a student, nostalgic about the old days, teacher, bus driver, as we heard, you name it. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. The big eclipse is coming, and if you're like me, all the eclipse news means a particular song keeps getting stuck in your head.
Well, turn around, Bright Eyes, because a lucky few people will get to see a live performance of the song in question.
The song, Total Eclipse of the Heart. The artist, Bonnie Tyler, the venue, an eclipse-themed cruise ship expedition.
Tyler will perform her 1983 hit live for cruisegoers as the moon heads across the face of the sun.
It has to be an abridged version of the song. Apparently, the eclipse is supposed to be less than 3 minutes. The song itself clocks in at over 5 minutes.
Yeah, and this is a really good song.
It's a good song, and one of the most puzzling,
from our generation.
One of the most puzzling and disturbing videos outside of the work of David Lynch.
Yeah,
famously weird.
Nobody should look up this video.
You should absolutely look up the video, especially if you don't remember it from back in the day. But I don't know. You're gonna see the eclipse a little closer up than
don't
me.
Don't jinx it. I'm hoping to see the eclipse, unless it's cloudy or it rains.
So are you gonna have an MP3 player playing Bonnie Tyler?
Yeah, no.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll check it out now to preview the eclipse. This is Central Time.
There's nothing I can do, a total eclipse of the heart. Once upon a time, there was light in my life, but now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart.